the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Welcome to What Radicalized You, a podcast of stories and experiences that have shaped people's ideas about our world and the way society should function.
Content warning: this episode contains mention of sexual assault.
Hi, my name is Kay Ortoyan. I use they, them pronouns. I'm 27 and I'm kind of from Michigan, kind of from Georgia, but right now I call Atlanta home. And I've been organizing for maybe 7 or 8 years. And I've been in a lot of different movements, but the movement I've been most consistent in and where I consider my home is working within prison abolition, working to fight against the prison industrial complex, and also fighting to support people who are currently incarcerated. And I'm a lesbian. I'm also disabled, and being disabled takes up a lot of my capacity, but it's also been something that's been great in the sense that it's kind of connected me to a bunch of different groups and movements, and it allows me to do the work that I do today, which is primarily on the Free Ashley Now campaign, which is a campaign to free my friend Ashley Diamond. I guess what radicalized me, so my mom was always really, really big into the news and politics, and she always really stressed how important it was to me to be informed and to follow things. And I had a middle to upper middle class background, but my mom grew up really poor in the country in Maryland. And so that really just shaped the way that she viewed the world, and it shaped the way that she navigated the world. And it was really important for her that I knew about what was happening to other people. And also it was important for her that I knew what was happening to Black people specifically. So I kind of always took that with me, and I was always really, really informed, but I wasn't really actually acting on my beliefs. And then while I was in high school, I joined Tumblr, the website that everyone was on, and I learned more about, I'm using this in quotation marks, social justice, but it wasn't actually something that I would consider myself organizing around or anything like that until I got to undergrad. And I went to undergrad at Georgia Southern University for 2 years, and it was a very difficult experience because it was in a pretty remote area. There's a lot of racism, a lot of anti-Blackness specifically, and a lot of homophobia, and it was just a difficult place for me to realize that I was a lesbian, or at the time I identified as queer. I knew I had these ideas, and I was learning to put names to what I believed in, and I was learning names for systems that were oppressing me, and I wasn't learning those in the classroom. I was learning them from my friends and people I was interacting with, usually just people who were in the Gay Straight Alliance or similar clubs and things like that. And one of my friends in those clubs invited me to apply for this fellowship that doesn't exist anymore, and the fellowship is called Young People 4. So many people have done YP4. That's where I met some of my best friends who I still talk to this day. So one of the components of YP4 was going to a regional convening and then a national convening. And I went to the regional convening in Chicago, and I met people for the first time who were I'm an organizer. I'm a paid organizer, or I'm doing grassroots work in this org, or I'm doing policy work. And that's when I was people have these views, but they actually can spend their whole life, or their whole job, doing something to enact those views. And that's when I was cool. So that's what I want to do. I want to be an organizer. So I went back to Georgia Southern, and after that experience that summer, I was completely changed. I'd gone to my first protest. I had all these really smart, active friends all across the country who are doing amazing stuff. And I just felt super stuck at Georgia Southern, and it led to me having a mental breakdown. And I had to transfer back to Kennesaw State, which is right by my parents' house. And that's when I was like, pretty much like, I want to completely change my life. So I took a semester off of school and I started researching orgs in Atlanta and also in Kennesaw and at Kennesaw State. And I started joining the orgs at Kennesaw State, even though I wasn't enrolled as a student yet. Through there, I kind of fell into this racial justice group in Atlanta, and I was driving to Atlanta back and forth like every day to go to protests, to do different things, to go to different trainings that like different orgs or nonprofits were putting on. Kind of just took over my life. And since then, I've always been working in some sort of form for justice. I've been an organizer, or I've been supporting other organizers' work. And that's kind of my story. I didn't know much about abolition when I started organizing. I didn't really know that there are people out there who believe that there should be no prisons or jails or cops. All I knew was a reformist view, because that was what was popular within the organizing circles that I was in at the time. And it wasn't until I got to grad school. And when I got to grad school, within a month of being there, I was actually sexually assaulted. And it was a very isolating and draining experience. And one day I was just on Twitter. I saw Miriam Caba's Twitter. She was talking about sexual violence within prisons. And I read an article that she shared, and my whole framework like changed. Basically, I was just making the connections that sexual assault was one of the worst things that could have happened to me, I felt like. And that's something that happens in prisons every single day. It's state sanctioned sexual violence. And we as a culture, we actually celebrate that violence. And so it was impossible for me to say that I wanted to keep other people safe, and that I wanted to end systems of sexual violence without starting with prisons, where it's happening daily. And so from then I was just like, wow, like, what the heck? Because my most long-term campaign until that point had been working on a reformist campaign. And so I was just like, whoa, like, I kind of don't think people should go to prison anymore. So I started reading more and doing a lot of work around it. Like in school, I was there for my master's of social work, and I would do independent studies, or I would make my research papers and topics about things that were meaningful to me. So I was researching policing or prison abolition. I was researching Afro-pessimism, researching like Marxism and socialism. And I kind of integrated that into my schoolwork, and also started a reading group with my friend, a Marxist reading group, so that we could learn more. And that was really amazing. And then when I moved to New York, within the first 2 weeks, I went to my first Survived and Punished meeting. And when I was there, Miriam Caba said two things, because there were a lot of new members there. She was just like, we only really have two rules here. No drama and do the work. So if you're going to sign up for something, you need to do it. And if you're not going to do it, you need to find a way to follow through. And I was just like, okay, I'm ready to do the work. And the first meeting, we had this in-depth discussion about R. Kelly, because I think that was the day that the day after the R. Kelly documentary had come out. And it was just such a rigorous discussion, and it was so validating to be in a room with other survivors who believed in abolition, where I didn't feel alone, and things kind of just took off from there. I was an active member in Survived and Punished, and then I joined the No New Jails campaign, and that was a campaign to fight against the city's plan to build 5 borough-based jails. And through the No New Jails campaign, I met a lot of different people, a lot of different organizers all over the country. And so when one of my friends was like, hey, I think I want to come up with something to counter 8 Can't Wait, which was a reformist campaign, I was like, sure. And that was in the summer of 2020. Abolition was really popular then. And I was able to grow my network a lot. And I was able to start a disability justice mutual aid fund with my friends, and we raised $66,000 in 2 weeks and redistributed it. And a lot of those people from the fund later became members of Free Ashley. And so for Free Ashley, I originally met Ashley when I was an undergrad. I was working in a paid role as an organizer for a group that no longer exists, and that was called Get Equal. And I never heard of Ashley's story, but my supervisor at Get Equal was like, hey, this Black trans woman activist is coming home to Rome, Georgia after being incarcerated. And it's wild because the first time I met Ashley, I still wasn't an abolitionist. So my supervisor was like, you live relatively close to Rome and we want to throw her a welcome home party with the students at Berry College. And so we hosted the party. Ashley came. All the students were there. Ashley spoke. It was really fun. Ashley was really funny. And we connected on Facebook. And we would like each other's posts here and there, but I never really heard from Ashley again. And I was moving across the country. And then one day, while I was in New York, I was on Facebook, and a Facebook friend shared a New York Times article about Ashley. It was about how Ashley was incarcerated. So I was like, why is someone sharing such an old article about Ashley? Because her initial time being incarcerated, it resulted in a legal case that pretty much changed the way that trans incarcerated people are legally supposed to be treated. So it was normal for Ashley to be in the New York Times, but I was like, why is someone sharing such a dated article? And I read it and I realized she was reincarcerated on a technical parole violation. And so I was like, what? So I looked Ashley up on JPay and we started messaging a lot. It was so good to catch up with her. Like, I was sending her pictures about my life, telling her what I'd been up to since we last saw each other. And then through talking with my friends, I was like, how would you feel if we started a survivor defense campaign for you? And she was like, totally. And then that's how Free Ashley Now was born. And we raise money to support Ashley's daily needs. We do a lot of strategy behind the scenes. We fundraise and we sell merch. We had a week of action. We collaborate with other survivor defense campaigns. And we do a lot of letter writing events. And I didn't know that we would still be here, like, doing all this work a year later. And there's definitely been a lot of ups and downs. It's been one of the hardest things we've ever organized on, ever. But getting a chance to, like, work with people that I love about a cause or, like, that is very important to me, and working to free someone who I love and who I care about deeply is, like, it feels really good, even with the lows. And so right now, it's we're kind of in a difficult phase, but that's kind of where it is right now. Yeah, we're learning a lot. Like, I know so much legal jargon that I never knew before this started. So if you want to support the campaign, you can definitely visit freeashleydiamond.com, and that's where you can find information about how to donate to her Patreon or her GoFundMe, our merch fundraiser, and sign the petition. You can also learn more about Ashley's story. And then you can also follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Twitter. And sometimes I make TikToks on my personal account, but we're working to, like, build that out in the future. The main thing Ashley wants is just for people to share her story. And she also appreciates, like, hearing from y'all. So if you want to write Ashley a letter, you can write it using our website, and then we'll handwrite it and send it to her. So those are the ways that you can get plugged in. When I was in grad school, I started experiencing back pain that I just pretty much ignored, but it was always there. Like, I was telling someone else, like, I remember my partner at the time, like, they would, like, give me constant massages, and then they, like, they stood on my back once just to, like, relieve some tension. But it was just something that I had, and I thought everyone felt that way. Then when I got to New York, I started working somewhere with my best friend, Jamie. And she also has, like, chronic neck and back pain. And through hearing about her experiences, I was like, wow, I also hurt, like, a lot. And over time, the pain was just getting worse and worse and worse. I had to stay home a lot. I couldn't really be as active as I once was. The pain was also making me nauseous. So if I was in a lot of pain, I would feel like I had to throw up, or I would throw up. And it was just a very difficult experience. And all I was doing for it was taking Advil and, like, Tiger Balm. And that's because I didn't think of myself as disabled. I just thought of myself as someone who has this really hard thing that, like, impacts their life on a day-to-day basis. But I didn't really know that many people who ID'd as disabled. And I wasn't really immersed into disability justice culture. And that was what made it hard for me to connect and find resources. So eventually, after a year, I started going to physical therapy and I started seeing some improvement, but it still, like, my pain never went away and it's still here now. And eventually the pain got so bad that I had to be hospitalized twice around a year ago. And that led to me relocating from Brooklyn to Atlanta because it's just more accessible for me. Like, the warm weather is better for my joints. I live closer to my family. I can have a car. But it was a really awful experience because I was not expecting to move. It was just completely abrupt. I was feeling really acclimated to Brooklyn. My best friends were like around the corner. And the experience of being hospitalized was so dehumanizing that it was one of the hardest times in my life. And I also found myself acting in ways that weren't aligned with my integrity because I was in so much pain. I was miserable. So I'm feeling a lot better physically now because I have like a pain routine and I have disabled friends here too. But throughout the process, for me, it really took me years to like deeply, deeply understand like what it meant when someone publicly like says like, I am disabled, and how that can completely shape the way that people interact with them, especially as someone who uses a mobility aid, which is visible. I use a cane a lot of the time. So that experience itself was radicalizing, but I want to say one of the most radicalizing experiences on my disability journey was when Eat to Abolition first came out, and we were called in by a group of disability justice organizers who pretty much said, not only is a site not accessible, but your language, the things that you're doing, the way that this is being promoted, etc., are not rooted in disability justice. And that was really difficult for me because I was like, I am disabled. But I had to learn that being disabled is not the same thing as like being in community, like, and being in like a disability justice space. Like, me being disabled is not an inherently radical act. I had to do more and I had to learn more. And it was really humbling. But now I would say that being disabled shapes everything that I do. It shapes how often I talk to my friends. It shapes what I eat. It shapes what media I consume. It shapes what organizing I can do. It shapes the language that I use. Small things that used to just be minor annoyances are earth-shattering now. But also, I have a lot more resiliency. And I'm also able to see the big picture of things. And so, yeah, it's just been really fascinating that something that I thought I would ignore and it would just go away has really, really, really completely shifted my life and my friendships, even my organizing. So, yeah, that's kind of how I realized, or that's kind of how I came to this, but it's still a work in progress. I still feel, out of all the identities that I hold, being disabled is the one where I'm always like, I could always learn more. I think that it's like really exciting that a lot of people are coming to like organizing, learning more about it. I'm just really touched and excited that people still continue to reach out to me about these things. It really keeps me going. So I'm just thankful to be here.